Well, here we are on a rainy day in Pasadena and looking forward to a conversation about your interview with Alan Yeh and his experiences in missiology. And we're kind of figuring out as we go what we're doing here, what this conversation is about, reviewing, engaging critically, accepting the provocation of Alan's own experiences and what that brings to mind for us.
Mm-hmm. So part of what we're doing is amplifying the positive core. That's how appreciative inquiry, people put it, those who study appreciative inquiry and promote appreciative inquiry as a methodology. The idea is that we are building on the interview stories to elicit these key themes, right, to draw out these key themes that underlie those moments when missiology was most alive or at its best, or when Alan Yeh's missiology is most alive and at its best. So amplify the positive core.
Yeah, well, and tell me this. Does that amplification, can it take the form of a critical engagement with things that are said where you're not simply saying, this is the best because I agree with it or mm-hmm. I like it, but this is the best because it really engages yep. important conversations, important concerns, questions that we need to address in missiology. What is the sense of best and positive?
Absolutely. So I think part of what AI does is AI is saying it's inviting us into the conversation, and it kind of sets the tone for the conversation, but it doesn't limit us to only talking positive, right? The dialogue involves, so when we come to the table and openly and honestly are sharing in a context that's democratic, you know, we are sharing in our passionate thinking and it's creative responses. And some of those creative responses are going to push, you know, kind of laterally against, or it's going to, you know, nuance things that have been said or stories that have been shared are seen in a new light. But again, the idea is let's focus on maybe some of these creative images of positive or preferred futures even. But it's something that we get to generate together. So we generate it together, bringing our context and our visions to the table as well. So in that sense, it does not exclude critique, and it doesn't exclude pushback. It is saying let the conversation begin from a position of appreciation.
Well, that's helpful. Thanks for clarifying a bit.
Let's talk about some of the best. Let's talk about ways that Alan is helping us think about the future, think about missiology. What are the life-giving aspects here? As we hear Alan, there are some wonderful things to focus on. So let's talk about those. What stands out to you, Greg?
I mean, the first thing, just overall, the game that we're asking people to play in these interviews is tell your story. What
yes.
are your experiences and
Alan
mission?
Did such a great job of that. He's a storyteller.
Yeah, I think it was tremendous, and it's clearly a narrative of providence for him. There's a strong sense of calling from beginning to end. There's a strong sense of God saying, this is how I'm going to lead you into a vocation of the study of mission. And so I just really loved the way he was able to tell stories about how he got from where he was to where he is.
To me, missiology, the strength of missiology, and I've said this, I think, possibly last time, but to me, part of the strength of missiology is the potential for making room for the agency of God, right? So where is God at work? And missiology as a field of study begins with this conception of mission is participation in what God's already doing, mm-hmm. right? God's already working. How do we get to be a part of that? So when we start thinking of our own stories and we start thinking of our own journeys as very much guided and instigated and orchestrated by God, you know, and us in our agency working with God in this wonderful dance, I mean, that's powerful, right? Alan is doing it. Alan's doing, you know, this great job of telling a story in a way that includes God's agency. I love that.
Yeah, I think that interestingly inverts the relationship between mission and missiology, which often we would think of missiology as a study that's sort of objectifying mission. But even telling our stories as students of mission, we're telling a story of participation in God's mission, is to recognize that even the study itself is a part of the greater mission of God. And I think that comes out particularly in Alan's story, in that I think probably as with many, many missiologists, there's a seamless relationship between experiences of mission work, going into places as a missionary, and becoming a student of mission.
Right.
And so those two things are so interwoven that you can't tell one story without telling the other.
That's right. Yeah. That's so true. I mean, that's true in my own life. I can. It was sitting in meetings with my mentor, Gary Jackson, in Beijing, China, as we are, you know, we're helping start churches. We're helping work with Chinese leaders to start churches in all over Beijing, mostly the northern sections of Beijing. And, you know, we're reading these books that are just helping us understand, make sense of what we're doing. But that was definitely that was the spark that ignited, you know, my own passion for missiology was, wow, there's people that thinking very deeply about what's going on and what God's doing in the midst of everything that I'm trying to strategize, right? And all these ways that we're thinking about, how do we reach my neighbor, right? I love my neighbor. How can I engage them more deeply? So that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So often it very much is a passion that emerges from practices.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it's more obvious, although I think this is probably true across the spectrum, but maybe a little more obvious in more conservative traditions. There's also, this comes out in Alan's stories, there's a strong connection between missiology and its home in the university being essentially about mobilizing and equipping students to go into the mission field. Yeah. And, I mean, we could think about that even at other levels of seminary training and master's degrees still being about mobilizing people to go into mission. Mm-hmm. So it's not just this sort of academic exercise in analyzing what missionaries have done or what they're doing or what should be the case in light of critical theory or whatever.
Right.
But it's really very much about equipping the students of mission to be missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so that becomes a part of this kind of cycle of I study in order to do, and then out of my doing, I become more of a student, and so missiology proceeds.
One of the things that I really appreciated about Alan is the way that he's in his own studies, he's crossing boundaries. Right? Mm-hmm. When I think of missiology as a field of study, I think of, you know, studying what happens to the gospel, what happens to the people sharing gospel and receiving gospel as we're crossing boundaries. And so I love that, you know, he's an Asian American focusing on a Latin American in his PhD studies, right? He's focusing on Orlando Costas. And even his studies for his most recent book, Polycentric Missiology, you know, he's thinking as an evangelical, and he's looking at, you know, these ecumenical movements and these councils and churches. And I just think that's fantastic. Alan is, in many ways, that's one of my favorite aspects of Alan. He's saying, look, I know I might get some flack in the future because I'm not studying, you know, an Asian American, or I'm not studying, you know, an Asian missionary or an Asian thinker, but, you know, my focus of study for my PhD is going to be Orlando Costas. So I appreciate that. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah. His sort of instinctive or automatic reaction as a student trying to participate in the Guild of Missiology is to study a European.
Yeah.
And his mentor,
Tennant,
puts him on a different track. And so, I don't know, what do you make of that? Like, what's the meaning of saying, we've got enough white guys?
Yeah, I think it relates to what he's saying a little bit later, where he says, look, I mean, you've got, you know, as Dana Robert has pointed out, and as Jenkins has, you know, popularized, Christianity is no longer, a white male living in, you know, middle-class America. It's actually, you know, a dark, poor woman that's probably Pentecostal, right, that's living in the global South. You know, that shift is significant, and unfortunately, perhaps until recently, that shift of you know, the centers of Christianity to the global south perhaps has not been reflected in academia and in scholarship as often. So you can see someone like Dr. Tennant going, look, you know, study one of them. Let's study some voices that have been less heard. But it is, I mean, it's an interesting, I can see how it's coming from that place. And I'm curious how, you know, you think about it as someone who is a white male and, you know, studying beautiful blue eyes that I get to look at right now, right? Someone who's studying.
Make it awkward, Mark.
You know, you're studying at Fuller Theological Seminary and you're looking at, you know, possibly teaching at a seminary in the United States. You know, and there's a context right now. I'm curious, what was that? I mean, you hear Alan, and what are your thoughts as you think about, you know, even his own study?
Yeah, well, I mean, my thought is probably to a great extent similar to Dr. Tennant, similar to Andrew Walls, as other white guys looking at the horizon and recognizing, look, this is the future, and you got to direct your students toward not only just the unmined riches of majority world voices that are underheard, mm-hmm. but also just orienting your whole career and your path of study not toward the past but toward the future.
Right.
And the reality is, we both need to hear these voices and simply will hear these voices.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
so.
Yeah.
So it's a wise course of action mm-hmm. to start paying attention already. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there is a sense in which you wonder, right? As a white guy, you go, okay, I mean, it ought to be harder for me to get a job. My voice ought to count less than it has in the past because it's been disproportionately heard in the past.
Mm.
At the same time, I still would like to participate in the conversation. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want my only job to be, yeah, I don't listen to people that look like me.
Right.
That I think that can go down a weird path.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's probably a ton we could say about that. I don't know even necessarily what I want to say about that. I just know I have an instinct, right? My instinct is yes, affirm. Let's listen to those who are different than me. I think that's the right posture for a Christian, period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's definitely the right posture for a society of dominant white people who are repenting.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I don't want that to go all the way to a place where we just invert the inhospitable.
Yeah, a colonial reversal, right?
Yeah. And as far as our context, I mean, you said we're in a context right now. That's it. I mean, we're seeing, I think, an inversion that's not very healthy.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing
mm-hmm.
Sort of vitriol and anger and all those sorts of things driving the conversation rather than a desire to move toward
mutuality.
Greater hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and there's certainly backlash. And I sense on my mom's side of the family, you know, German from Iowa, and my dad's side of the family, Latin American, mostly here in Los Angeles. And, you know, there is a sense of, from my mom's side of the family, talking to them that we're being ostracized from a conversation that we never felt we really had a say, we had a voice in just because of the color of our skin, and pushback, right? There's mm-hmm. a lot of pushback, and I think that, I mean, obviously, some of their support of our current president, President Trump, is related to that desire to not be ostracized and not be marginalized from important conversations, but. Anyway, I digress.
Well, it's an interesting digression. You know, I recently listened to, are you familiar with the philosopher Žižek?
No.
Mm-mm. He's a Slovenian philosopher. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce his first name.
Okay. Go for it. Just try.
Slavoj.
Perfect.
I don't know.
Good job. You nailed it.
But he was just recently talking about sort of extreme PC culture and the context in America, and saying that the problem is that there's a lot of people that are not, they're not using their voice as they protest the patriarchy and the system that's privileged a very few people. They're not using their voice as they protest that in order to create real mutuality. Mm-hmm. They're using their voice, and they're even crying foul, even when they're legitimately victims. Mm-hmm. They're using that just to gain power, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's a power play.
Right.
Yeah. And those dynamics, which Christian theology identifies as sin, mm-hmm. are just, they're just a real part of this whole conversation where we're trying to navigate, even if we just limit the discussion to, do you write a biography on a European missiologist or a majority world missiologist, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What does it mean for me as a white missiologist, a male missiologist, mm-hmm. to tell students, no, look at somebody who's not a white guy. We got enough white guys. Mm-hmm. And all of that, are we simply seeking a new position of power, mm-hmm. or is this really about hearing? Is this really about welcoming? Is this really about a better, more Christ-like, more reflective of the kingdom sort mm-hmm. of situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I can recall an analogous conversation in the writings of Orlando Costas when he's addressing Latin American scholars that are embracing a liberation theology. And they're embracing it sometimes, you know, wholesale, and versions of liberation approaches that were both violent and tended to their ultimate aim seemed to be putting the oppressed in power. Right, again, not mutuality and hospitality was not the end goal, and Orlando responding to that, I have to look that up again, but it's a similar kind of dynamic, right, where yeah. it's like, what's the ultimate goal here? Because of Christ, the ultimate goal ought not to be, you know, your sudden, it's a reversal of power, but hospitality, mutuality.
Yeah.
One of the other things that I appreciate that Alan brings up is he brings up this relationship between world Christianity and he brings up missiology. So mm-hmm. missiology and its relationship to world Christianity. And I appreciate that he brings this up because it is a question right now. I mean, how do we understand the relationship between this study of what happens to Christianity in six different continents, you know, as they embrace the gospel, and the gospel suddenly looks very different than the gospel as I understand it, right? So that's the study of, as Alan was explaining it, you know, global Christianity or world Christianity. And then missiology, and how does missiology fit into all of that? So what do you think? I mean, it's an interesting question. How would you answer that question?
Yeah, I think it's initially just a fraught question because in some ways the rise of the world church generated what's now famously known as the call for a moratorium on missions, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was world church over against mission, right? Mm-hmm. Now we have a world church. We don't need you coming anymore. We'll right. take care of our own neighborhood.
Which, by the way, just keep in mind, you know, that world church was actually a few denominations that were primarily Western, right? But we're going to call it a world church.
Right.
We're going to say that this is the world church, even though it's the world.
Anyway. Yeah, I mean, but that's but sort still. Of the early iteration of the conversation,
yes.
right? Is that
yeah.
what do you do once the West is sort of looking at fields where it has sent missionaries, established churches, whatever form, whatever denomination, and then starts to think, well, so is mission just this limited thing that we were doing, and now churches can just do church? They can just, we'll call it ministry, and they can just be church, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's even on that level already some tension, at least. Mm-hmm. Now, I think in the contemporary conversation, it's way messier than that.
Mm-hmm.
We made it past that moment where it's clear that not only is the West now profoundly in need of and in fact receiving missionaries from the majority of the world, and those churches are themselves hubs of mission, as the thesis of Allen's book, right? Polycentric missiology indicates.
From everyone to everywhere.
Right? Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But also we've come through the beginning of a conversation now called missional theology, in which I would suggest as a participant in that conversation that there's no such thing as a church that is not connected to the mission of God. Essentially,
mm-hmm.
There's no such thing as a church that's not in the mission of God.
Yeah, and I think we should clarify this because some may hear that and misunderstand what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
So elaborate just a little bit. Just unpack that a little bit for us.
Well, I think the fundamental claim is that God's very self and God's own nature is missional in that the relationship of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit is one of sending, which is in Latin missio, mm-hmm. right? So that's where the missio Dei theology takes its name. But that, therefore, the very nature of the God in whom we live and move and have our being is a relationship that we can characterize justifiably with the word mission,
mm-hmm.
and that the church in Christ and in the Spirit and the church sent by the Spirit in God's ongoing mission in the world therefore exists.
Mm-hmm.
And so to conceive of mission only in the limited sense of the sending of the Western Church of a handful of people into foreign places
mm-hmm.
is a misconception of mission.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that wasn't mission also.
Right.
But it wasn't the extent of mission, and it was also, and continues to be in many places, caught up with the questions of colonialism and the
imperialism.
Relationship between those sending countries, which tend to be wealthy and powerful, and the countries that receive missionaries, which tend not to be,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. So, all of that to say, the relationship between the study of world Christianity and the study of mission
mm-hmm.
is complicated, and can be conceived in a number of ways. I tend not to want to dichotomize them.
Mm-hmm.
I tend not to want to say mission is about those activities in which missionaries, say, evangelize or make disciples or plant churches or do social development work sort of beyond the boundaries of their own culture or whatever. Like, we can name a whole bunch of different things and we can conceive those more or less holistically. But I tend not to think of mission as just those things,
mm-hmm.
and then whatever comes after that in the form of churches as the study of world Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But rather, because world Christianity is itself a part of the body of Christ that exists in participation in God's mission,
mm-hmm.
world Christianity therefore encompasses the study of mission,
mm-hmm.
and indeed conceiving of the relationships between very different iterations of the church
mm-hmm.
all over the world already entails the kinds of intercultural relationships
mm-hmm.
and differences and interactions between the other
mm-hmm.
that missiology has always been about in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously world Christianity can't just be about navel gazing. It also has to be about the relationship between the world church and its surrounding faiths,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and the worldviews and social structures that exist all around it and within it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so those boundaries exist as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder how Allen would respond to that, and I wonder if perhaps his response might be something along the lines of, you know, you can't tell the story of world Christianity or global Christianities without first telling the story of missionaries,
mm.
right?
Yeah.
Spread these,
absolutely.
The good news. And I wonder if that's part of the, you know, he's saying, you know, what came first was Right. Let's talk about what came first. What came first was people deciding to cross boundaries, mm-hmm. and then you can start studying what happens in the midst of those. I'm interested to hear what Alan would say to something like that, to your response, because he actually seems to say something a little bit different a little bit earlier on, yeah. right, where he kind of compares global Christianity, world Christianity, and the study of world Christianity to discipleship, and, you know, missiology or missions to evangelism.
Right.
Right. So the study of missions is equated to evangelism and
pre-gospel, post-gospel.
Pre-gospel, post-gospel. Yeah. Right. What happens after, you know, we bring the gospel to them, and then suddenly, you know, a version of Christianity emerges that's very different than, yeah. than our own. And so yeah. let's study those differences.
Yeah, I think that sort of conceptualization actually runs contrary to the primary notion of polycentric mission.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
That these post-gospel disciples are the ones that are doing mission.
That's right, yeah.
And
you're right.
So it just, I don't know, it's sometimes it's just a bit of a mess, and it's not, I don't want to say anything as boring as that it's, well, it's just a chicken egg thing,
mm-hmm.
right? I don't think it is. I think it's a problem that we're wrestling with and we're trying to find the language for. Mm-hmm. We're trying to usefully conceptualize what it is that people who study mission now, today, mm-hmm. are actually doing. Mm-hmm. Because our context is a world church in which the majority of believers, the majority of sending churches, mm-hmm. the majority of people who are engaged in mission mm-hmm. are not those who did the evangelizing mm-hmm. 100 years ago.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. And nor so, are they the ones that are writing books on missiology today.
Right. The future of this is that we already talked about the inextricable relationship between mission and missiology, right?
Mm-hmm.
Practicing leading to study, leading to practicing, leading to study. Well, naturally, the people who are sending missionaries to the West now from the majority mm-hmm. world, they're going to be on the cutting edge of reflection. And that's going to lead into probably new ways of theologizing and mm-hmm. Practicing the study of mission and conceptualizing things. And so,
yeah,
that's missiology is going to come out of the discipleship of the majority world church
mm-hmm.
because you can't be a disciple without being a participant in the mission of God.
That's key.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, and that's part of the assumptions, right, that we're talking about. You can't be church without being engaged in participating in the mission of the Spirit, the Father, and the Son. Or you can't be a Christian, you can't be a disciple without engaging in these practices of evangelism, right? That just becomes part of what it means to follow Jesus. When I think about the relationship between world Christianity and missiology, I think I agree with you that I see the larger, the umbrella being world Christianity and missiology being that study of all of those wonderful hybridities and interactions between all of these different Christianities and also between the Christianities and all of the other faiths and peoples and cultures and worldviews and ideologies that we're surrounded by that are part of our context. You know, what happens as we engage the other? Whether the other calls himself a, you know, a follower of Jesus or not, right? What are all the different wonderful things that happen to the message, the messenger, those who receive the message, and how we're mutually changed in these interactions? To me, that is part of the that's when I think about missiology and why I'm excited to study missiology and to be a part of this field of missiology and these conversations. It's exciting because it's all about engaging the other. Right, it's all about engaging the other, whether that person is also a Christian in another context who understands God differently, or the other as a neighbor who maybe in my very own context does not believe in Jesus, right? So they're coming from an ideology, a worldview that's very different than mine. But what happens in all of that interaction, and what is God doing in the midst of all of that, especially the agency of God question, right? So what is God doing in the midst of all of that? All of these wonderful encounters where we have opportunity then to practice hospitality, practice mutuality, right? We have all these opportunities to practice not objectifying the other, but engaging them as agents in their own right, on their own journeys of you know, finding truth, looking for meaning in life. And so to me, that's part of why missiology is fascinating, and part of what I think why I agree with you that it would fall in my opinion, it would fall under, it would be a subset of the broader study of world Christianity.
Here's another question. You ask what Alan's hopes for the future of missiology are, and here's his response. He says, what I would love to see is for the West to empower the majority world with books, resources, and money so that they can influence people around the world. And he goes on to say, we need to help equip them because we still have the majority of the money. So what does that spark for you?
Yeah.
You hear that as a hope from a young missiologist coming up, training a lot of students.
Yeah, so I think that within Alan's context, I can totally understand where this is coming from, right? So he's talking to evangelicals in this country that are probably mostly, you know, I'm guessing mostly middle class. I mean, he's thinking about students that are going to Biola, for instance, right? That's his context, and he's thinking about, you know, our emphasis in churches in the United States that has primarily been, you know, I got to raise up Martin, and I've got to raise up Greg, and I've got to, you know, send them out because they're going to be the missionaries that our world needs. And then Alan being very aware of the fact that in our, you know, in Christianity as it's journeying today, no longer are missionaries looking like Martin and Greg, right? I mean, cross-cultural missionaries are increasingly looking like Brazilian women, right? Pentecostal, charismatic women. And so my guess is that part of what he's saying is, hey, look, we've spent too much money on ourselves, right? We've spent too much time and energy equipping ourselves so that we can be those who go out and do this, you know, God's mission. You know, we are the ones that need to make this thing happen. We as in Westerners that have the money and the power, and in recognizing, oh, wait, there's a bunch of other people out there that are moving and we need to participate with them and help them out in what they're doing. We need to equip them, empower them, because they're already doing it. And I think that's the key phrase is, and that would be a little bit of my hesitation with that hope, right, is that they're already doing it. And Alan's well aware of this, right? Without the money, without our equipping, right, without our theology, our books on in our seminaries, to use his words, you know, dark women in the global South are participating in what God is doing in the world, you know, regardless of whether they have Western assistance or not. And I think that would be the nuance, right, to the hope, is that's an awesome hope. And it's something that we do need to be generous, right? Let's be generous. Let's find ways that we can partner and participate with what our brothers and sisters in the global South are doing and the ways that they're thinking of, you know, participating in God's mission in the world. But I think that it heard from a different stance, though, it could be heard as somewhat colonizing.
Yeah.
You know, it can be heard as, you know, we've got the money and the power, and ultimately nothing's going to happen unless we help you guys do it. And I know that Alan doesn't mean to say that at all. Yeah. And, you know, I know that he's, you know, would not want to be heard that way. I think it has to do with context, right? Who's hearing these hopes? Who's hearing this podcast? And it is true that when I sat down with him and he was asking me, who is hearing this? To be honest, I told him it's going to be, you know, Western professors, Western students. You know, I told him it was going to be missionaries. And he knows that it's happening in English, so it's going to be primarily missionaries that have some kind of contact with the West and Western culture. And so he's talking to his audience that he thinks is listening.
Right.
I think that as missiologists, though, we do need to think about that broader context, right? What's happening more broadly is that that it's happening without us, you know, and it's not our job to, you know, plug them in and give them the resources. It's actually probably more of our job to just listen and learn, right? What do you think? I mean, what were your thoughts?
Let me follow up with this. So I like that. You know, there's an intuitive wisdom to saying, well, if we're gonna spend the money, if we're going to spend the money, let's not spend it on ourselves. Mm-hmm. Let's spend it on seminaries in the majority world. Let's spend it on equipping this future wave that is the majority of the church's missionaries. That makes good intuitive sense. My question, though, is, are there any dangers in that? Mm-hmm. Even if that's sort of a logical next step, there is money in the West. If we're going to spend it, let's not spend it on ourselves. For me, the next question is, are there dangers, are there problems that creates? Aside from just the colonizing, what is that kind of vision of the use of resources and equipping do in those contexts?
So Timothy Park, in our interview with him, is going to get into this, and he does a great job of really just telling stories about what this looked like. You know, for him, as a Korean missionary that is bringing the resources and how that shaped. He's the first one to tell us, you know, it actually misshaped his engagement in God's mission in that context. So
I'm going to look forward to hearing that.
Yeah, definitely. There's a plug right there. And we got to definitely hear Timothy Park, because in a very humble way, he says, look, it was impossible for me to sit in the room and have an equal voice with them, or them have an equal voice, when I'm the one paying the bills and footing the bills. That ultimately came down to, I can't co-lead if I'm the one that is, you know, paying their salaries. They don't feel comfortable disagreeing with me or coming up with ideas.
Which means that it becomes not the facilitation of local contextual theology,
right,
but the roadblock to local contextual theology.
That's right.
Which is the thing that Alan is dreaming about, and that I share that same vision, is how do we foster, what can we do to incentivize or empower or whatever positive word we can come up with, so that there is an explosion of rich, different local contextual theologies in the world church.
Right.
Among those who are going to be doing mission.
Yep.
And sometimes I think the answer is get out of the way. Mm-hmm. Simply get out of the way, mm-hmm, and let those local resources and local ways of doing things be enough in the hands of God for that to happen.
Yeah.
It's just a question. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to do, because...
And you don't want to become isolationist, right? That's not the idea. It's like, get out of the way doesn't mean don't participate.
Or partner, but what is good partnership? What is friendship?
Right.
What is that?
And how
like?
Is that done? And what does it look like? I mean, certainly that is one of the big questions in missiology right now. What does this even look like? And how do we do partnership in a way that doesn't, where my power and the power dynamics are just ignored, but they actually are prevalent? How do we do it in a way? And my guess is that when Alan is saying, you know, let's publish and let's start seminaries, he's thinking of, and these seminaries may look very, very profoundly different, right, than they look in the West, right? They're not going to be Western seminaries. They're not going to be publishing what Westerners are going to want you to publish. And my guess is that he's thinking, you know, these are going to be very, even though I'm using the word seminary, I'm thinking there's paradigms that are going to be very different than what we've seen in a place like Fuller or a place like Biola, and you know, the publishing or the academia, it's going to come out, it's going to be very, very different. But the question, though, is, we do need to be aware of the power dynamics, right? Let's be aware of how even the word empower can be a very dirty word, right? It can imply that we're the ones with the power, and we're sharing power.
And they don't have any unless we give it to them.
Right, exactly.
They're powerless, and thank goodness that we are going to be generous enough to give them power.
Exactly. So on one hand, that's incredibly imperialistic. On the other hand, and colonizing.
Patronizing.
It's patronizing, thank you. And on the other hand, it's also, as missiologists who are thinking about the agency of God, the question is, well, what about God's power in all of this?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, isn't there a third party here that is incredibly important, right? And who is it that does the empowering? Is it us? You know, if we're going to use the word, let's use it wisely. Let's use it. But maybe it's a word that coming from a Western seminary, in reference to people in the global South, our brothers and sisters in the global South, it's going to be more problematic than helpful because of, again, the paradigms that for some people it brings up. It brings up, oh, okay, I see what you mean. You know, you're equipping me because, you're empowering me because I don't have the tools on my own.
Yep. At the same time, I mean, I want to swing back and say, I just really appreciate the forthrightness of the way that Alan's talking about money.
Yeah, thank you.
Because there it is, right? Yeah. I mean, we can start using coded language and say, well, we're talking about partnership, right? Well, what we mean is we're talking about there's some of us that got a whole bunch of money and there are others that don't, and we're trying to negotiate how to make that transfer.
Right.
And so there's something that's healthy about just saying, look, we're talking about missions and money.
Right.
Right, which is a whole sub-conversation in missiology that's very, very important.
Yeah.
And as well as when helping hurts and toxic charity and right, all of these dynamics that are basically about monetary resources and the power that that gives and the influence and the relationships that that shapes necessarily. And so so it's a really interesting lead in to say the vision of the future, the hope has everything to do with how we end up negotiating that.
Yes. And that's the key, right? That's the hope. The hope that, you know, that those are voices, whether it happens in the shape of through seminaries or whether it happens through new publishing, but these are voices that need to be heard.
Yeah.
Right? These are voices of God's people that we in the field of missiology need to be welcoming with open arms, hospitality, and with mutuality. Recognizing all the different wonderful ways that God in his wonderful creativity and in all of his agency has been empowering and equipping long before we arrived, you know, long after we're gone, and even in ways that we didn't intend, right? They were not even a part of our strategies. But these are voices that need to be heard.
Absolutely.
So what was his other hope?
Well, his first one out of the gate was
focus on discipleship over evangelism.
Right. But that actually, what he goes on to explain what he means by that is building more seminaries in the majority world, majority world scholarship.
Yep.
Particularly, he mentions Bible commentaries and then ecumenical conferences that lead to new theology and new creeds.
Right.
So you see the whole vision there, right? Yeah. There's this sort of natural movement from the transfer of resources to the facilitation of indigenous theology through seminaries and then through publication that leads to conferences, which in the context of his discussion in polycentric missiology of ecumenical councils and other world councils on mission, what this means is a gathering of the most visionary and informed leaders in missiology having a rich discussion that results in new theology, that results in new movements and even new creeds, right? New confessions of faith. And so there's a real coherence to that vision. It makes a lot of sense, at least on paper.
Or historically, right? Yeah. Oh, this is how it's been done. This is how we've seen it happen. And again, perhaps our response would be, it may look very different.
Right.
Right? It may look very different when it actually starts to happen.
And the delightful thing about his willingness to say new creeds is precisely for traditional Christianity.
Right.
New creeds is jarring.
That absolutely is. Right. And that needs to be emphasized, that he gets there.
Yeah.
I mean, he's getting to the point where he's saying there are new ways of understanding God that we... I mean, because creeds have been historically very divisive, right? I mean, let's talk about creeds in a way that is positive, that's nuanced, and that's new, and that is different than what's come before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think the hope of people that wrote creeds in the history of the church was that they would unify.
That's right.
Right. The intention was to identify and articulate a shared confession.
Yeah.
Shared ground. And so I think that a lot of people, when they hear the phrase new creeds, what they hear is divisiveness, right? We're not going to agree if it's new and there's old. And I reject that notion. I think that there's something wonderful about the endeavor to articulate shared faith,
yes.
Right?
Right.
But the thing is, missiology in particular insists that that endeavor has to happen over and over in new contexts.
That's true. Yeah.
Where you can't simply, I mean, you can't take a medieval strategy and just say everybody's going to say it in Latin,
mm-hmm.
no matter what their context.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't take what some might argue is a little bit of an imperialist strategy, which is just we're going to translate into your language our creeds.
Yep.
But instead, we're going to put you in conversation with our creeds, and then you're going to articulate faith from your perspective, in your context, in your language, in fresh ways. And God willing, because we are one church, we're going to do that in conversation with each other in ways that are faithful to the tradition and faithful to who God is in the present and in the future.
What you're getting at reminded me of Lamen Sane.
Oh yeah.
You know, translating the message, the missionary impact on culture. Within Christianity itself, there is this impulse for translation. It's an impulse for translation,
yeah.
Right? It's grounded in the Pentecost and the cross event, you know. But this impulse to that at once relativizes and empowers human culture.
Mm-hmm.
But to constantly be translating, the gospel is constantly crossing borders. It's needing to be translated. It never ends,
yeah.
Right? And as part of that, there's these creed writings. The creeds are ultimately still relativized because of the continual process of translation.
Yeah, because translation, much to the chagrin of the colonizer, is a reciprocal process.
Right.
Right. And so it automatically has its own effect on what's translated, and the thing becomes new in a new language, in a new context. But it also, this is what I was saying, right? It is a colonialist proposition to say the thing that we're talking about has already been articulated, and all we need to do is make your language useful.
Mm-hmm.
To say the same thing.
Right.
That's a misapprehension of language.
Yes.
But it's also a way of proceeding. It's a way of conceiving what's happening with the creeds that really needs to be challenged beyond the level of what the language itself is already doing to the creed in translation. Mm. Right? There's a whole other sort of liberation where that translation is just part of a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That then continues, and faith comes into articulation in fresh ways.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Here's a quote. No culture, this is Sane, which I love that Alan brings up Lamen Sane, and as a shout out to Lamen Sane and his family, you know, we as missiologists grieve his departure. I think it was just in January, just recently he passed away.
Yeah, after the interview. Mm-hmm.
No culture, he says, is so advanced and so superior that it can claim exclusive access or advantage to the truth of God, and none so marginal and remote that it can be excluded. I like that. It's a great quote. And which highlights, again, the ongoing missional task, right? The ongoing work of missiology is how do we include these voices? Alan, on behalf of Missiology Podcast, thank you again. And to our listeners, thank you again. All of you who are helping make this ongoing project an ongoing project. So thank you for all of our Patreon members. And join us next time as we listen to who's next?
Amos Young.
Amos Young. Okay.